Moncrief with Gas Networks Ireland. Aren't you tired of that ugly fuel storage tank, having to order and write that big check for the delivery guy? gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.
Now, Silicon Valley often revels in the hubristic belief that it can solve all sorts of societal problems, but it doesn't stop there. Transhumanism is the growing idea that technology can eventually conquer death. Mark O'Connell travelled around America meeting devotees of this idea for his book, To Be a Machine. Mark, good afternoon to you.
Hi, Sean.
There's an astonishing variety of people that you spoke to, but to kind of, I suppose, start at the less fringy edges of it, in Silicon Valley, there are extremely wealthy people who are funding all sorts of research into this.
Yeah, I mean, the really sort of high-profile people you might mention would be Peter Thiel is sort of the biggest figure in all of this in terms of his enthusiasm for it. He's a big public advocate of like what's known as radical life extension, and his money is everywhere. I mean, I didn't talk to him for the book. He's a very difficult guy to get near to, obviously, but his money was kind of the sort of unacknowledged protagonist of my book, in that it's, you know, most of the people that I talk to, most of the technologies that I'm looking into, he's invested in all this stuff. So he's a sort of a major kind of advocate of transhumanism.
And as are Google.
Yeah, I mean, Google, the Google founders are hugely invested in this stuff, literally. They're particularly the life extension kind of end of things. They founded a company called Calico in 2014, around the time I started writing this book, which is a life extension research kind of firm. And their sort of stated brief is to push out the boundary of mortality.
Yeah, and but do they give any information as to what Calico does or exactly what areas it's looking into?
I mean, you can kind of find out by who's involved in the company. So it's mainly sort of biogerontologists. It's very much kind of life sciences, biologists. So they're kind of taking a less sort of sci-fi approach to this stuff than a lot of the things I'm looking at. They're sort of looking at cell biology and those kinds of things. So they're not necessarily talking about immortality as such, like a lot of the people I'm dealing with. But yeah, they're looking to push out the sort of horizon of mortality.
Yeah. I suppose on the biological side of it, there was almost kind of old-fashioned approaches like injecting the blood of younger people into older rodents just to see does that work.
I mean, Peter Thiel is a big advocate of that stuff, which leads to all kinds of vampire analogies that he gets. And, you know, it's not the only way in which you might seem like that. But yeah, so there's all kinds of approaches. And, you know, there's a lot of debate within the scientific community, and that's putting it mildly, as to how sort of realistic and achievable this stuff is. But so it goes from that sort of, as you say, kind of old fashioned scientific approaches to, you know, ideas as radical and sort of extreme as scanning our brains and uploading them to machines and becoming like literally disembodied sort of intelligences. And this is kind of the bedrock idea of transhumanism. You know, if you talk to any transhumanist for long enough, they will have some or other version of this belief that it is our destiny as a species to merge with machines, to become sort of technology.
Yeah. And also I kind of got the sense that there was almost a sense of disgust with the fleshiness and fragility of their bodies.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, this is one of the areas in which transhumanism has an awful lot of crossover with kind of old time religion. And I'm kind of uncomfortable describing it as a religion. I don't think it is, because there's no God figure. But yeah, it's motivated by very similar kind of what I see as sort of basic human discomforts with the fact that we are these sort of flesh and blood creatures with urges, and, you know, we're falling apart, we're all dying. So, you know, I think it comes from the same place of anxiety as religion.
Yeah, and that idea of transforming ourselves somehow, does that go hand in hand with still remaining as an individual, or do you become part of some huge AI?
It depends. I mean, it's a weird. There's some weird paradoxes when it comes to this movement or ideology, in that it's motivated by a kind of a really extreme extrapolation of like liberal humanism. This idea that, you know, we are these like selves, we are these like autonomous kind of beings, and we have to kind of, you know, strive towards perfecting ourselves. And it's an ideology of the self, very much, of perfecting the self. But also, you know, it pushes it to such extremes that it almost obliterates the idea of the self, in that there's no boundary between our bodies, ourselves, and technology, and that we would merge ultimately with, say, artificial superintelligence. So the idea of the self kind of becomes almost irrelevant.
Yeah, so that's kind of slightly contradictory then.
It's hugely contradictory. There's a real paradox there that, you know, it's they're aware of it, but they're sort of less motivated by philosophical questions than you or I would be when we encountered these strange ideas. They're much more motivated by how do we get there, you know?
Is there, or I don't know if it's a direct association, but would it tend to run parallel with particular political views of the world?
I mean, again, I'm wary of like sort of backing them into any one political corner. Transhumanism is very much a broad church, but it grows, like the movement itself, as opposed to the ideas, grows out of libertarianism. So there's a lot of, I mean, Silicon Valley is rife with sort of techno-capital libertarianism. So there's a huge amount of kind of that ideology in there. But at the same time, you know, I met transhumanists who were socialists, you know, transhumanists who were deeply religious, Christians, Buddhists, a couple of Muslims. A lot of Mormons, weirdly. Don't quite know why.
But okay, yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Would they see then that the transhuman, however it's achieved, but this kind of form of immortality, you know, would they, especially in Silicon Valley, would they see this as something, as a gift to the world, or just something they'll sell to rich people?
Well, like, this is an ongoing conversation, and like they're aware of the sort of weakness in their sort of humanitarian rhetoric, in that, you know, inevitably the people who are most invested in this and the people who are most likely to benefit from these technologies, if they do come about, are the super rich. So, you know, the person most clearly associated with it is Peter Thiel. The argument that they tend to use would be some version of, like, these technologies will sort of trickle down, you know, almost like that sort of...
trickle down economics.
Exactly. I mean, it's the same sort of argument with the same weaknesses. But yeah, I mean, they would sort of say that, you know, it's like your cell phone, your mobile phone or whatever. You know, 20 years ago, they were massive and they were only available to, you know, commodities traders on Wall Street or whatever. But, you know, now everyone has one. So there's some version of that argument that goes on.
Okay, a cheaper form of immortality will eventually become available.
Yeah, yeah, I wouldn't hold my breath. But.
Now, one of the places you also visited, which has been there for a long time, is Alcor, this place where bodies or parts of bodies are frozen. What does that look like when you get inside it?
It looks like any building in an office park. It is literally in an office park. You know, I point out in the book that it's between a place called Big D's Floor Covering Supplies and I think a carpet warehouse. And so you walk in and it's like this sort of, you know, it's not unlike News Talk. You walk in, there's a foyer, you sit around and you wait. But then you go in, and I did a tour of the place, and you walk into what's known as the patient care bay. And this is where, well, first of all, they process the bodies, right? So the recently deceased people who've signed up for this program, once they reach clinical death, once they die, they're taken in and their bodies are perfused with like a sort of cocktail of chemicals to stop the cell breakdown. And they're put in these gigantic sort of thermos flasks called Dewars. And so there's a really bizarre kind of sci-fi vista that you're greeted with, where you walk through and there are all these like huge sort of stainless steel Dewars, and you know that they're containing dead people and a lot of beheaded people, because the system is, I mean, I think you pay $200,000 to preserve your whole body and $80,000 for just the head. That's purely because space.
Yeah.
But I think the idea is that most people, when they do come back to life, when technology reaches such a point that it's sophisticated enough to bring us back to life, it's obviously a big if for you and I, but the idea is that they're not going to need their wrinkled old bodies. They'll want to upload their brains to sort of...
Of course they will, yes.
Robots, yeah.
And that's still doing business on an ongoing basis, is it?
I don't know if they're making a massive killing, but they're doing okay. Yeah, sorry,
pun intended.
Well, yes. Actually, yeah, sure, pun intended.
But people are still signing up for that then.
Yeah, they do okay. Yeah. Peter Thiel has signed up, Ray Kurzweil has signed up, a lot of these tech guys.
And how long has it been there for?
Cryonics as a practice has been around in some form or other since like the mid 20th century. Alcor has been around in some form, I think, since the 80s. And they kind of, they moved from California to the Sonora Desert to Arizona in, I think, sometime in the mid 90s. So they're not, I wouldn't say that they're expanding necessarily, but they're sort of holding their own in a fairly small market. There are four cryonics facilities in the world, three of them are in the US. And
right, yeah, because you'd wonder how they make, you know, for a one-off payment, and in 20 years' time, that one-off payment mightn't be worth anything like it's worth now.
Yeah, I mean, it's life insurance. I mean, that is one of the big sort of questions hovering over the whole thing. I mean, how long are we going to have to wait till technology can bring us all back? And, you know, how long is that money going to last? And,
yeah.
You know.
Now that's kind of, if you like, the more mainstream elements of it. One that leapt out at me is the very appropriately titled Rowan Horne, founder of the Eternal Life Fan Club, who's going to remain a virgin.
Well, that's what it looks like. Yeah, yeah. He's he, as he sort of reveals to me in the book, he's saving himself for sex bots. Mm. He's, I mean, Rowan is a really, like, a really quite eccentric character, but his sort of worldview is very thoroughly worked out, and he's sort of evaded any kind of risk of premature death, and that includes for him having sex because of the risk of STDs. So he's saving himself for sex bots. And yeah, we have a really sort of strange conversation about that in the book, where he convinces me that this is the only kind of rational approach to life, that it's too risky to have sex.
But I suppose a lot of this does have its own internal logic.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I sort of use this phrase, magical rationalism, in the book, by which I mean the strange experience of meeting these people and spending time with them and having conversations in which, you know, most of the scenarios I'm in the book, I'm kind of the least intelligent person in the room. Mm. Like, everyone I'd spent time with was, like, really, really smart, really sort of hyper-rational. But the places they were taken to by that extreme rationality were often kind of insane. Mm. So, I mean, the thing that I realized at a certain point in writing the book was that, you know, as I say, like, rationalism can often be the handmaiden of insanity, of unreason. So, you know, they're taken to these very sort of, I think, explicitly kind of religious endpoints by an extreme investment in extreme reason.
Though I suppose that religious belief, it's a religious belief that stems from the technology industry.
Well, that's
particularly the computer industry.
Right. And that's what they will say to you when you make the inevitable point that this seems kind of like a religion. They'll say, yeah, sure, it's offering similar kind of escapes from our human condition, but the difference is that this is purely rational. We can at least theoretically achieve these technologies that can release us from the human condition. But
because I suppose the other similarity to a religion, now, and most people of religious belief don't necessarily practice this, but the idea that the next life will be a better life. So a lot of all the people you talk to, did they kind of value this life less because they thought they could have a better one?
Again, there's a weird sort of paradox in that they think life, I mean, in all cases, they were very much optimists, as in they thought life was an absolutely good thing and being alive was non-negotiable, that we should never, never relinquish it. But also, yeah, it's not good enough. Like, these bodies are not good enough. We're not smart enough. We're not strong enough. We're not resilient enough, and we need to merge with machines to sort of bring about a transcendence of this kind of, you know, failed condition, which again is very much like the sort of, you know, I kept thinking of the Christian idea of the fall, as in we are fallen creatures and we need to transcend that. So, yeah, I mean, it is an outgrowth of religious thinking in a lot of ways.
Did any of them give you a timescale on when any of this might start happening? Because some of it is real technology.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it's based on what we can do now. It's based on extrapolations from where we are now. So, I mean, the big figure, arguably, in all of this is Ray Kurzweil, who's the director of engineering at Google, and he wrote this book called The Singularity Is Near. And the singularity is this idea that he's popularized that, he says by 2045, he specifically says the year 2045 is when artificial intelligence and various other technologies will have sort of got to a sufficient degree of sophistication that it's kind of our destiny, whether we like it or not, as a species, to merge with AI, and that we're going to sort of reach this great transcendent kind of moment in our development and become something other than humans. Mm. So it's very much, I mean, you can map it onto a kind of an eschatological way of, you know, religious thinking, as in, you know, the rapture is coming. It's often referred to as the rapture of the nerds.
And it is he the one, he'll be 120 when that happens?
No, he's not. I mean, Ray Kurzweil is like maybe 70-ish now. So, I mean, he takes dozens of vitamin pills and various life extension pills every day. He just constantly ingests these pills. So he's quite confident that he's going to live long enough to, just about long enough to sort of experience the singularity. And at that point, he'll live forever.
Now, whether the singularity wants to have him live forever or not is another question.
He's probably going to be first in line.
Mark, thanks a million for talking with us today. That's Mark O'Connell there. He's the author of To Be a Machine, Adventures Among Cyborgs, Utopians, Hackers, and the Futurists Solving the Modest Problem of Death. We're going to take a break. Back in a couple of minutes.
Moncrief.
with Gas Networks Ireland. Aren't you tired of that ugly fuel storage tank, having to order and write that big check for the delivery guy? GasNetworks.ie/movetogas.